What is it?
Going to open the House Committee on Rural Communities Land Use and Water. I'm going to ask the DSL to come up, and I, at least, I've had a lot happen in the last 48 hours. I need a refresher on what House Bill 2461 does. I remember well the discussion about the paper versus, you know, electronic for the second set of copies of things that are being done by agencies. But I don't remember 2461 and what the need or point of this was. So could you refresh us on that?
Yes. So for the record, my name is Bill Ryan. I'm the Assistant Director of the Aquatic Resources Management Program, the Department of State Lands. And so, Chair Klem, members of the committee, the House Bill 2461 is essentially a fix of an inadvertent deletion of authority that happened as a result of Senate Bill 600 last full session. And so that Senate Bill 600 clarified some of the exemptions that the department has for registrations and leases and that sort of thing on submerged and submersible lands. And it removed the ability for the department through rulemaking to offer low-cost registrations as opposed to a full-on lease for things like non-commercial structures.
You could give them a lower-cost fee, and right now you can't.
Correct.
I remember now. This was a fee reduction one versus the other one. I remember thinking, oh, okay, you're not going to have problems with people showing up mad about fee reductions. They're about increases. Okay. Okay. So, any questions on that? Where's that?
No, I think that's fine.
Yeah. Okay. That was what I needed.
Okay. So let me open a work session. Why don't you stay there in case we need you on other ones on House Bill 2461.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2461 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 2461 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? If not, the motion passes. Bill goes to the floor. So, it says roll call, and roll call is not required.
Right. What's the, so if you were to do a roll call, you would do that. So,
okay. And why don't everybody's here? I can't assign somebody. Oh, Vice Chair Post, would you like to carry this one?
Yeah,
I'll assign the other vice chair.
I'll be honored.
All right, it's a fee reduction thing. I think.
I just want to appreciate
decent fees in Salem.
Yeah. Okay. Let me open a work session on House Bill 2462. Colleagues, this is the one requesting permission to be able to store those second copies of leases and deeds that are kept with agencies in paper form. And maybe with other agencies in electronic form, but this is the second copy that is currently with them in paper right now, and they would like to be able to do it electronically. Any, let me get a motion on the table anyway.
Chair Klem, I move HB 2462 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Helm moves House Bill 2462 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question for you. Are you comfortable with this bill and comfortable enough that it is not a major, I'm going to need your help with vocabulary,
security
data
risk.
Security issue, it's more an efficiency.
Yeah, given these are public records which are available at the other agency, even if somebody, you know, hacked in and got a copy of the lease between the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission and the office building in there, there's nothing sensitive about the data because it's already publicly available anyway. So I wouldn't worry about privacy issues. And then from a, you know, cost standpoint, it obviously would save some money, and much as I like paper being printed, in this case, there will still be some trees killed and paper printed at the other agency, so I can probably live with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
One quick question.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Klem. I have to just ask because it's the way I am. I wrote it down so I make sure I say this correctly, and I want to convey this properly. Will there be any additional costs to the people of Oregon at any time, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 1 year from now, at all, that you can think of?
Chair Clem, Representative Post. Not that I can think of. I mean, this is something we already have a process for storing records electronically, and so it's really just a matter of you know, paper reduction and space. You know, it would actually open up space and perhaps reduce our need for storage in the long term.
And you're not planning on hiring new FTE in order to scan these things or something like that?
No, we're not.
Yeah, that would be where the cost would be, probably.
Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? If not, then the bill passes. And Vice Chair Hall, how would you like to carry this one?
I would love to.
We're going to find one for the consent calendar. 2463, I want to hold over. Representative McLean had some questions about the due process part on the finding that something is abandoned and whether or not people would have any recourse if they didn't think it was abandoned. They still thought it was usable, but you don't, for example. So I'd like you to meet with him and go through that before we do anything with this bill. So I'm going to carry over House Bill 2463. And then I would like to invite Director Koba up from the Department of Ag to talk a little bit about the industry and a little bit about maybe her agency, and then we'll hear one at least of their agency bills. Okay, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Katie Koba, the director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. With me is Lisa Hansen, deputy director of the department. And we're going to give a bit of an overview of the agriculture industry in Oregon, some of our key issues, and a little bit about where the department intersects with the industry. It would take me a long time to go through a good overview of the department. But you have two documents being handed out to you. One is the State of Oregon Agriculture. This is a biennial report that is done by our State Board of Agriculture, and the State Board of Agriculture is a 10-member board that's appointed by the governor. It has really good information for you in terms of key issues for the industry, as well as a regionalized perspective. So we have Willamette Valley Coast, Eastern Oregon, if you care about certain regions of the state. And then the second document is the biennial report of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And so that goes through in greater detail the programs that we have in our agency, program outcomes, goals, and those kinds of things. So in your leisure reading, because I know you're not getting any kind of material at all in the positions that you're in, here's a little bit more for you. With that, give you a kind of an overview of Oregon agriculture in the state. I think the great news is that agriculture is doing very well, and our farmers and ranchers and fishermen in the state are very proud of their accomplishments. We exceeded a record in terms of output from production on farms and ranches a couple of years ago. We broke the $5 billion mark in terms of farm gate value, so that's the value of products that are sold off of the farm. And when you add all of the processing, transportation, marketing components that go with agriculture, Oregon agriculture represents 15% of Oregon's state economy. It's been a steady contributor to our economy, and I think the future is indeed very bright, particularly when you think about some of the global dynamics that we're dealing with. Proposed population for the world to reach 9 billion by 2050, and the fact that right now with the current land base in the world, not in the United States, not in Oregon, but in the world, and our current technology, we can't feed a population of 9 billion by 2050. So there's going to be a lot of things happening in our industry here in the next 20 years or so. A lot of it's going to be driven by technology. And that certainly, those dynamics certainly impact our industry here in the state of Oregon. Oregon agriculture is very, very diverse. If there's one word that I use to describe it, it is diverse. And our agency, respectfully so, is also diverse in order to meet the various needs of the industry. Our number one producing sector in Oregon agriculture is nursery and greenhouse. followed closely by cattle and calves. Top five include hay, dairy, wheat. On down the top 10 list, onions, potatoes, Christmas trees. We're number one in terms of production in things like grass seed. Number one in the United States, hazelnuts, potted florist azaleas. So we are blessed in the fact that we're incredibly diverse. We also have very diverse markets. 80% of what we produce in Oregon leaves our state's borders, and of that, half of that moves into an international market. But I think the exciting thing and what we're seeing in agriculture here in the last decade is just the passion around the local food movement, whether it's farm-to-school efforts, whether it's farmers markets. Anywhere you go in Portland now, it's all about food carts. Pretty excited to see the number of food carts that are going into the Portland airport. That's fantastic. And so we embrace all of those market opportunities for Oregon agriculture, whether it's what we can do to encourage local market and local market consumption, continued efforts around domestic opportunities, and of course international market opportunities. So with that, I'm going to talk about a few of the challenges that we're facing in our industry and related to markets. I think first and foremost on a lot of our producers' minds right now is the challenges being that we're all facing with the West Coast port slowdown. This is a phenomenon that's larger than just Oregon, and the fact that the agreement between the Pacific Maritime Association and ILWU expired last summer, and negotiations are underway, but there are a number of challenges for all West Coast ports right now. And what we're starting to see, and I think bigger than just the fact that right now we're struggling to get product moving into market, is the long-term ramifications of these port slowdowns. I just received a copy of a letter that was sent to the governor yesterday from our Japanese consul general that's based here in Oregon, and they are very, very concerned about long-term displacement of Oregon and U.S. products in foreign markets. Since we can't get our products there right now, foreign markets are looking to source their products from other countries, and if we lose those market opportunities, it's going to be a big challenge to get them back. Unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do at the state level to influence this other than to talk constantly with our congressional delegation about the challenges that we're facing. The last time this happened in 2002, the president ultimately stepped in, and if we can't get the negotiations to speed up and be resolved, that may be something that we'll be requesting in terms of an industry ask to the president. Another area, challenge and opportunity, I think, for us, and it's a little hard to talk about water, given what we've been experiencing the last few days and given what the chair has been experiencing. I know personally some of us would like all this water to go away. But the reality is we face water shortages in Oregon in the summer on a fairly regular basis. And despite the storm of the last week, we are still very, very low in terms of snowpack. And given that, we are looking at irrigation water supplies to be shut off later this summer. That has impacts on our producers. It has impacts on what they choose to plant right now. And if you're trying to irrigate your crops or water your livestock in the late summer, those are some big challenges that we're facing. I'm excited about the continued investment in this current biennium in terms of water, both water quality components as well as water quantity opportunities, and the governor has included additional investments in his proposed budget for 15-17 for water quantity efforts. This includes continued focus on conservation as well as exploring new opportunities for supply development. So this is a huge priority for the industry and one that we in the department are very, very engaged in. The third issue I would raise that is also front and center for us right now is our animal health program in the state, and the fact that animal health diseases or animal health outbreaks are not good things for our livestock industry, and we've just witnessed that with the discovery of high-path avian influenza in the state of Oregon, first in a couple of wild birds and then in some backyard poultry flocks. So we have the state vet in our agency, and our incident response for animal health diseases was activated right before Christmas. Again, it brought back really bad memories of my first year on the job when we had the first case of BSE in cattle that was discovered in Washington, but we were very much involved in that issue as well. Fortunately, the high path situation so far in Oregon has been much more manageable, but this is an issue that we see that we're going to have to deal with here for the next few years. And it requires quite an engagement of our agency with our federal partners as well as the private veterinarian community. We've struggled historically with funding in our animal health program, and so I think this certainly raises the profile of the importance of adequate funding in that program. As a result of the high path case that was found in the backyard poultry flock, we've had 30 countries that have now banned poultry products from the state of Oregon. Some of those banned poultry products from the United States. So it's just an example of how diseases in livestock have economic ramifications for our producers as well as for producers in the United States. The third issue, I guess I'm on the fourth issue already. The fourth issue I will touch on briefly. Some of you have been spending a lot of time with us on this issue, and that is the use of pesticides in agriculture in the state and also pesticides in forestry. We don't administer the Forest Practices Act, but we do have the pesticide regulatory program in the state whereby we license all pesticide products, we test and license all applicators. I guess we register products, we license applicators. We conduct pesticide investigations both on a routine basis and to respond to complaints. And clearly we've had some high-profile pesticide incidences related to human health that have caused a lot of concerns about the use of pesticides in the state. I think those are going to be some issues that we're dealing with in the course of this legislative session, and certainly we're available to answer questions and talk to you about how we've been engaged in responding to these situations. The next issue is an equally challenging issue, I think, for all of us, and that is genetic engineered agriculture and how we are going to use that in the state of Oregon. We've had a local ballot initiative related to the production of GE agriculture in Jackson County, whereby production was banned last year. We had the most expensive statewide initiative on GMO labeling just late last year, and we will be dealing with legislation, I know, this session also talking about genetic engineered agriculture. So it's another topic we've been spending a lot of time on and certainly are available to answer questions and try to help guide how this issue moves forward. I think I would sum up my comments, and I'm certainly available to answer any questions, by a word that I'm using a lot lately, and it pertains to both how we within the industry are working together as well as how industry is interfacing with its neighbors, and that is the need for continued focus on coexistence. You'll remember I opened up by saying we are an incredibly diverse agricultural state. Here in the Willamette Valley, we are incredibly diverse. But it's a relatively small geographic area, and we are challenged by growing populations. And how different kinds of agriculture coexist with each other and how they coexist with their rural residential neighbors or even urban neighbors seems to be a growing challenge for us. And I think it's a place where we need to collectively spend a lot more time and attention in terms of education and outreach, encouraging farmers to talk to each other, encouraging them to talk to their neighbors, whether it's use of pesticides, whether it's impacts on pollinators, whether it's noise cannons, you name it. We're dealing with all of these issues in agriculture, and I think it's really incumbent upon all of us to encourage coexistence and working together as we continue to see the value of this incredible industry to our state. So with that, I'll pause and happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Director Coba? Initially, anyway.
This is a first. We'd like to move on to our bill then.
Yeah. Okay, let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2445.
Great. So House Bill 2445 is, we would consider this a housekeeping bill. It makes cleanup to a number of our statutes affecting our plant programs, our animal health programs, our food safety programs, weights and measures, and eliminating our statutory reference to the Interstate Pest Control Compact. We like to regularly go through our statutes and make sure that they're up to date and relevant and eliminate those things that we think aren't necessary anymore or clarify those things where we think we need clarification. This bill should be non-controversial, and I'm going to ask Deputy Director Hansen to walk you through the bill.
Thank you, Director Koba. For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. So rather than walking you through the bill line by line, I'm going to kind of just go through the summary of the issues that are in the bill, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer those. There are several sections that refer to our plant laws or plant quarantines, and this bill proposes to eliminate the requirement to publish quarantine notices in the newspaper and allows us to publish them through two common means, which means we would look to using more electronic means of providing notification. And we believe that really is the heart and soul of why this piece of legislation was in place in the first place. It also looks at our plant law and does some common language cleanup. It uses the term plant pest throughout and eliminates different references to different types of pests, as well as defines infected and infested for the purposes of the plant law. As you move through it, there's another section that relates to quarantines in our animal health law. This does the same thing as the plant laws, where it allows us to use two common means of providing notification, eliminates the requirement to file our animal quarantines with county clerks and publish those in the papers. It also eliminates reference to the grade B milk statutes. In Oregon, the laws have changed over time, and we have only grade A, and so this is a common place to just clean up the statute and eliminate those as well. In our weights and measures program, we're proposing to eliminate some of the authorizing statutes for renewable fuels that were put into place in 2009-ish. We've met those initial triggers back in 2011, and so this leaves the standards in place but takes away the initial requirements to trigger different parts of that statute. And finally, it also affects some references to the ASTM standards that are in statute. These would be more appropriate in rule. We've had issues with getting the right numbering in place, and those change from time to time through our national organizations. And it eliminates a national program that has been dissolved, the Interstate Pest Compact. So with that, I will pause and see if you have any questions.
Questions for Lisa? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the notice of quarantines, et cetera, I came across a number someplace that local governments and agencies spend $20 million a year putting notices into newspapers. And I like the idea that you're moving away from that, even though very often those ads help small rural newspapers stay solvent. My question to you is this. You're saying that we're going to eliminate publishing in newspaper, which I think is really not very effective in providing notice to the public, and instead going to an online kind of notice. Do you think that publishing this information on some obscure web page is still going to satisfy our goal of reasonably ensuring that affected people will get notice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg. So the change in the bill authorizes us to at least use two different means. So that may be having a list of affected parties where we would send email notification to. It could be using social media where people are connecting to the agency through social media, as well as putting it on our website. And those are the methods that we've initially looked to try and get the word out as much as we can.
Mr. Chairman, so you're suggesting that this electronic approach would be more effective than what we're doing right now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gomberg, we believe so.
All right, thank you. And I apologize for referring to your webpage as obscure.
Just killed us.
Representative McClain.
Hi, Ms. Hansen. Sometimes the quarantine notices go out in areas where, in a rural population, you've got perhaps some people who don't frequent the internet. They have may have email, but I am concerned that is a decision that, you know, I'd be curious to. Let me put it this way. Even though you believe it would be more effective on a website or social media, is there any data which would confirm that?
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, we do not have any data that would confirm that.
I think I might add, Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, we do know that there is data on farmers and ranchers' personal use of the internet, and it's Oregon is actually one of the highest states in the United States in terms of their access and using the internet, so that's probably a good tool. I think one of the things that we would certainly do is, if it makes sense to still publish it in a rural newspaper to target the audience that we need to target, we would do that. And I know in a lot of the groups that we have, I think about our invasive species we were just talking about it today. The Invasive Species Council, they have an incredible network. You know, it's kind of the people that are engaged in these issues anyway. So I think it would be incumbent upon us to make sure we're getting to the people that we need to get to with the right tool.
Follow up. Well, good. I'm cautious. I mean, obviously, not everyone here may be aware of the pervasiveness of the use of farmersonly.com. I'm sure Representative Gilliam's district is a high user. But nevertheless, I'm cautious. I'm protective of rural newspapers. People still read them. They're still useful. And I confess I'm hesitant on that. I need to know more. I need some more convincing. And then grade B versus grade A milk. The assumption is that this is for human consumption as opposed to other farm animals.
Mr. Chair, Representative McLean, it would be for human consumption. The difference was grade B was used for different manufacturing purposes rather than fluid milk.
Okay.
And we now use grade A milk for those manufacturing purposes in Oregon.
Follow up then. Is there any, while there may not be any manufacturers, do we know if there's any consumers of grade B milk in Oregon? I mean, do we have someone bringing in from out of state or something grade B milk?
So we'll have to check into that with our dairy people. But to our knowledge, only grade A is manufactured in this state based on the standards that the industry had helped us apply back in the early 2000s, I believe.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I want to go back to something Representative McLean said. So I'm going to line 23, I think it is, where the bracket is in a newspaper of general circulation throughout the state, and then this replaced by one or more methods that reasonably ensure. I'm going where you were going, Representative McLean, and it sounded to me like, if I'm reading this right, you could be doing both. You're not eliminating newspaper, you're wanting to add electronic. So in other words, if that's true, then why take that bracket? Why take that section out? Why not just say and both?
Representative Clem, Representative Post, it's really to eliminate the requirement to use newspapers. It could be a newspaper and, if that's the appropriate audience. It's about trying to find the best and most efficient methods to provide the notification. And there is some cost savings if the newspaper is not the best method for that use.
Okay, I think it speaks for itself.
Further questions? This one right now, anyway.
Okay, got no members of the public on this one, so I'll ask you to follow up with Rep. McLean, and we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2445 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2148 and ask our Bruce and Justin to come up. This bill, colleagues, has a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee, and so we are somewhat hopeful that we'll be able to get all of our questions answered today, because there's a day in particular coming up next week that we're hoping it can be heard in the Revenue Committee if we've satisfied ourselves of about it before then. So we're going to hear today, try and deal with anything between now and Thursday. The goal would be to get any questions answered by Thursday so we could move it to the Revenue Committee so they could hear it again over there during the time when the tribe's here. But we will see how much trouble these two cause us before we promise anything. So please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde, where I'm also a tribal member. We are here in full support of House Bill 2148. Thank you so much for the opportunity to have it heard today. As you may or may not have heard during interim hearings, all nine tribes have worked on this bill with their tax administrators. We're also very pleased to have had a wonderful dialogue with the Department of Revenue, the Oregon Association of County Assessors, the Association of Oregon Counties, and others in really fleshing this out before we brought it to the legislature. With me today is Bruce Zimmerman. He is a tax administrator for the Confederated Tribes of Umatilla, and he can really get down into the weeds on this stuff if you guys do have questions. As many of you know, Oregon is truly unique when it comes to state-tribal relations. From Governor Atiyah establishing the Commission on Indian Services, to Governor Kitzhaber's Executive Order 9630, to the Oregon legislature's putting into statute that executive order and creating Senate Bill 770, formalizing the government-to-government process, Oregon can really be proud of their unique history in government-to-government relations. We've done things like delete offensive language from Oregon geographic board names. We have dealt with illegally held archaeological objects. We've created a full-time Indian education specialist, and we've passed tribal police, given them the ability to work within their communities. As many of you also know, we are a true driver in rural communities throughout Oregon. We're very proud of things that we have been able to offer, and we really feel that we're able to help ourselves, which in turn helps our communities and helps the places in which we all work, live, and play. Why do we need House Bill 2148? One, there's a lack of clarity in state law that is discouraging economic development on tribal trust lands because of the fear of double taxation, which harms both Oregon and tribal economies. Tribes already provide and pay for governmental services on trust land, and we need Oregon statute to be consistent with controlling federal law. We think that this bill will help us to avoid costly and unnecessary litigation that was seen in Washington and other states. Some of the benefits of this bill, again, you'll hear from Bruce in a minute, but we think this, we know this will clarify in statute current Oregon practices that we are already doing. It will be revenue neutral. It will help to promote that economic development that I spoke about earlier and allow businesses to have some legal certainty when looking to locate in and around reservations. And then finally, in keeping with our long-standing tradition of government-to-government relationships and the wonderful work we've been able to do over the past couple decades, we feel that 2148 really exemplifies how we move forward in dealing with sometimes difficult tax situations. So thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and we look forward to hearing more from the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I really do thank you for the opportunity to take some time today to talk about a very important issue to the tribes, property taxes and House Bill 2148. We view this as a very important issue for us in that it really will help solidify and clarify the tax issue dealing with that. My name is Bruce Zimmerman, and I am the tax administrator for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. It's often referred to as the CTUIR. I've been employed since 1996 as the tax administrator for the Confederated Tribes. Prior to that time, I worked 10 years at the Oregon Department of Revenue in the property tax section. So the area of taxation is one area that I'm very familiar and very comfortable with. But before I start, I wanted to provide just some quick background on and context of who the tribes are. Specifically, the Cayuse, Umatilla, and Walla Walla tribes are three sovereign nations that entered into a treaty with the federal government in 1855. As part of that treaty, the tribes ceded 6.4 million acres in southeastern Washington and northeastern Oregon. As part of the treaty, they reserved their sovereign authority, and they also reserved a homeland, which is known as the Umatilla Indian Reservation, which is located in Umatilla County in northeast Oregon. The tribes have had a long-standing relationship with the federal government where they recognize the tribe's sovereign authority to manage their affairs and manage their territories. The tribal government, the CTUIR tribal government, has a constitution. We have our own tribal laws. We have our own independent court system, and we have budgets and work plans. The reason we have the government and these structures in place is to provide essential governmental services to all reservation residents, both Indian and non-Indian. Such services include education and schooling, public safety, water and sewer, land use planning and zoning, transportation, housing, social services, economic developments, and an independent judiciary court system. These services are funded from a host of various funding sources: the federal government, grants, contracts, tribal funds, tribal taxes, and intergovernmental agreements with other governments. In 2012, the Oregon tribes contributed more than $1.5 billion in economic output statewide, supporting a total of 13,153,000 jobs, which what resulted in nearly $507 million of wages and benefits. Specifically, the CTUIR is the largest employer in Umatilla County, with 1,750 full-time employees, of which approximately 60% are non-Indian. The state of Oregon has long recognized this relationship of the tribes on a government-to-government basis. And Justin did a good job of summarizing some of those actions, which have been very beneficial, because overall, this working relationship of the tribal governments and the state of Oregon on a government-to-government basis is very good. It results in good governance and good policy development and decisions, which we are very much in favor of. It is in the spirit of those goals that the CTR has worked with the eight tribes, the Department of Revenue, the county assessors, and the governor's office over the last 2 years in multiple meetings to really to develop the concept of how to codify very straightforward and make it clear House Bill 2148. It should be noted that this legislation only applies to trust land located within Indian Country in Oregon. Indian Country is an established legal term that means all lands within an existing Indian reservation. Currently, there's 9 Oregon reservations, off-reservation dependent Indian communities, and off-reservation trust land. Fee lands, which are privately owned lands held by tribal governments, individual tribal members, individuals, or non-Indians, is not affected by House Bill 2148. Trust land, which is what this legislation is limited to, what it means is that this land is actually owned by the United States government in trust for the tribal government or a tribal member. The United States, therefore, has an obligation to make sure that they manage this land in such a way that it is the benefits and beneficial use of that land flows then to the tribes or to the tribal members. Pursuant to federal court rulings and a federal statute, which is 25 U.S.C. Section 465, trust land has always been exempt from state and local property taxes. House Bill 2148 then is based on 3 recent developments that have occurred over the past 2 years. The first being in 2012, the Bureau of Indian Affairs which has the federal agency responsibility for carrying out the trust responsibility to the tribes, issued a regulation declaring that permanent improvements, that's real property, located on trust land are exempt from state and local property taxes and can only be taxed by the tribal governments. Then in 2013, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a decision in Chehalis Tribe versus Thurston County, Washington, Board of Equalization, where they ruled in favor of the Chehalis Tribe, and that decision indicated that Thurston County did not have the authority to tax the permanent improvements which were located on tribal trust land. And what was at issue there was a resort, hotel, and other local assessed property type issues. Then the final thing that really occurred within the last 2 years was the Washington Department of Revenue issued an administrative rule really to implement the Chehalis court decision and to provide some clarity and direction to the county assessors and so forth. And so you had those three events occurring. And so what we did was work together to come up with House Bill 2148, which takes those events and puts them into practice. I do want to, in conclusion, indicate that 2148 does not disrupt or change local property assessment practices. To our knowledge, and we've asked all the tribes and the counties affected to identify, and we haven't found any, where any of the local governments are currently taxing any permanent improvements on trust land. And so, therefore, since none is on the tax roll to implement this, the fiscal impact would be zero because there's no tax revenues currently flowing in. But one of the key components that this bill will do is it will provide tax certainty. And this really goes to the heart of economic development, especially for the tribes in some of our rural areas, is one of the main questions whenever you have a developer come in, they always want to remove risk. They want certainty in all these issues. Well, one of the issues is taxes. Who are they going to pay the property taxes to? Who's the taxing jurisdiction? And what we could tell them at this point is we can tell them what the past practices have been statewide. We can tell them in Umatilla County, the county has never assessed any permanent improvements on trust land. But what we can't do and what they often ask is, can you point to a state statute that really clarifies that tax policy set out by the legislature? And that's what we can't do. And that's really what this bill does. It puts in, it codifies existing federal law and federal statute and makes it really clear so that it provides that certainty when it comes to economic development opportunities and investors are looking at putting down hard dollars and creating jobs. I do want to indicate overall that tribes have been very, very pleased with the collaborative effort that the state and its agencies and departments have done in this process. The Department of Revenue, the county assessors, and so forth have been very willing to meet and discuss and flesh out this issue so we could get some clarity on this issue. And we think that House Bill 2148 is an important product grounded in good governance and good tax policy. It makes sense. And we also think it's a great example of where you have the tribes and the state working hand in hand to take an issue, clarify it, and resolve the issue to the benefit of all parties. And so at this time, I'd like to thank the other eight tribes for working with us in the state of Oregon. And we look forward to working with the legislature in answering questions and moving this concept forward. Thank you.
Any questions? Yeah, Representative McLean.
Thank you for your presentation. It is clear. The Ninth Circuit Court case of Chehalis versus Thurston County Board of Equalization, I think is what you described. Was that based upon a federal constitutional preemption of the authority of a county or state to tax federal government property? And if it wasn't, what was it based on?
It was actually based on two factors. It was that federal statute that I referenced, that USC 25, 25 U.S.C. Section 465, which is a federal statute. The other thing it referenced clearly was a prior Supreme Court decision that was issued in 1973 called Mescalero, and that was a property tax case where the county in Arizona tried to assess a tax against a tribe, a ski resort, and the Supreme Court ruled that the county did not have the authority to impose property taxes on permanent improvements on trust land. And so the Chehalis case followed precedent from the 1973 Supreme Court decision and also the federal statute.
Just follow up. Serious follow up. So if the law's been clear since 1973, are you saying that the potential business development investors are unpersuaded by the doctrine, or at least a precedent that gave the Chehalis case its certainty?
They're not dissuaded by it. What it is, they're always after real certainty, and what they're saying is it's an Oregon tax. The discussions I've had with potential developers is they say this is an Oregon property tax system. We want to see Oregon have a policy that is consistent with federal law, and so they're always pointing to the Oregon statutes, and right now there is no mission. There is no Oregon statute that really clarifies this issue. So that's what we're really asking for, is to go ahead and take that federal law and federal tax policy and put it into Oregon statute so it's really clear. So we've got something that says, yes, the state of Oregon, here's their policy, and it's very consistent. So there's no need to ever be afraid, or there's no potential for unclarity and litigation, which is what we're trying to avoid.
And are the tribes open to putting in language that would be clear that this statute simply affirms what exists already, which is a federal preemption from taxing?
Put the language in of a federal preemption? We would not be opposed to putting those words in there.
Just in the absence of that, because that's what you're asking for, is that we're preempted, we can't do it anyway, just make sure folks know.
Yes.
But maybe, Justin, you could come talk to me about that. I think it might, there are other folks in the state who want certainty. So what's nice is you're asking us to simply affirm what we can't do anyway.
That is correct.
It's a safe haven when you actually say that. So, and if you don't mind us saying it, it might not be a bad to just say it. But at the same, I don't want to hold up the revenue committee from its work. So in the end, if it's maybe they should just do it instead of us.
So we could, send it with that advisement over there Thursday and maybe talk about it in the meantime, see if we can come up with any language. But if we have something worked out by then, but not the paperwork, then maybe we could still send it over there so you'd be ready to go with that basic rough concept already in mind. That seems reasonable?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Representative Gillian.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here. Although this seems like a small issue, I certainly agree that it could be extremely helpful to reinforce, particularly for investors and economic development. In addition to the judicial, particularly federal court, that's obviously backing this, do you have other friends in the federal government that you've called on as we fashion this bill, or that you need to? Where are our friends to fortify this point of view in the federal government?
That would be the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And they issued, in 2012, they issued a set of rules, administrative rules, that clarified exactly this issue. So that has already been in place. They went effective January 4th or 5th of 2013, I believe.
Good, that's helpful. Follow up, Mr. Chair. What about our federal delegation currently?
I have not talked to our federal delegation specifically about this. We've been working mainly with the Oregon Department of Revenue to make sure that it was sound good tax policy from an administrative standpoint on their side.
Sure. And Mr. Chair, I don't need their fortification. I just think it would be great if they would weigh in support as well. It won't stop me from supporting the bill, but it's just a suggestion.
Thank you.
Anything else on this at this point?
Okay, and those are the only two witnesses I have at the moment. Mr. Landauer, did you want to have me ask your question, or do you want to come up here? The question was basically, would anything here prevent a sewerage agency serving a casino from still continuing to be able to do so and collect fees for doing so?
A which?
A sewerage?
What you mean like a city sanitation providing water sewer services? That's not a property tax, so this is only dealing with property taxes. So they would be entitled to charge a fee for service.
Okay, great. And do you want to come up here?
Chair Klein, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Sorry, I wasn't here to sign up in time. The League is concerned with the language that's on, let's see, line 20 of the bill, because it doesn't include just property taxes. It lists fees, charges, and assessments. I think the intent was to focus on property taxes, which was the Ninth Circuit case, but the language is rather broad, and it's written in the passive, so it's fees on the permanent improvements. So there is a concern that services provided by cities couldn't be actually charged. Water fees and sewer fees would be amongst those. So for example, Pendleton, that city does provide water to the casino, and there's a charge for those services.
I think that answers my question, Mr. Landauer's. Okay, great, thank you. Anybody else here on this bill? I don't have anybody on my sign up, but just checking with that. Okay, and you guys will come see Representative McLean maybe right after. And anything else for committee? This is the end of the public hearing. We'll have a chance to talk about this bill more, but anything else for the moment on this bill?
Can we go see Representative McLean?
You're welcome to. Okay, with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2148. And I will, not to get into too many details, but I'm dealing with a very difficult personal situation. It's lucky that I'm even here today, but I probably will not be here Thursday and maybe next week at all. So I will leave it in the capable hands of my two vice chairs to coordinate a little bit on what plans we have, but at least for the ones we have here, I'm not immediately planning on doing anything with 2460, I guess that was three, until I hear a little report back from Representative McLean, and then hopefully we will be able to do something here with 2148 next week. And then I'll hear back from the Department of Ag and Rep. McLean about some of the rural newspaper issues before we know what we're going to do with that. And with that, I will adjourn the committee. Thanks. With that. And with that, I will adjourn the committee. Thanks.